We're sort of getting to the end of it and thinking about activism and passivism, which will have a lot to do with the things that we've done earlier in the week. Today I want to consider what it is that keeps most American Christians from being activists. We are committed, at least in name, to a person who was an activist, an insurrectionist crucified for his activism. In his case, in fact, insurrection was a necessary precedent for resurrection. And there's not a lot in the scriptures, if you think about it, about taking it easy and getting comfortable. But a great many scriptures of American culture call us to comfort and convenience. In many ways, there's a conflict between our Christianity and our culture, as we have seen this week. And this cultural conflict often occurs within our individual minds. Most of us are Christians, most of us are Americans. And the conflict actually goes on within our minds. It's sort of a schizophrenia that we have in our minds that operates a lot of the time. Because cultural values and practices call us in different directions. Now, one way that this conflict shows up in American culture is as a conflict between activism and passivism, spelled P-A-S-S-I-V-I-S-M, not pacifism, but peacefulness. Activism is an active quest for peace and justice, paying attention to means as well as ends. A person who is an activist tries to act in ways that are not violent, and in ways that uphold the dignity of all human persons. Any such action, however small, is a form of activism. And I would like to suggest that activism and pacifism, now spelled with the C, are integrally related, exemplified, I think, by A.J. Musty's dictum that there is no way to peace, peace is the way. This is what I particularly want to talk about today, is the ways in which the ways to peace and justice are as important to the ends of peace and justice, that the two of them have to work together, and we need to keep both of them in mind all the time. Pacifism, on the other hand, is an inactive adherence to the status quo. If you're passive, you're acting in favor of the status quo. Pacifism is a combination of ignorance, apathy, and or perceived powerlessness that keeps people from working for peace and justice in their lives. Unfortunately, I think it's true that American culture supports pacifism much more than it supports activism. And today I'd like to explore a whole variety of isms that inhibit activism, or what I would call cultural props for pacifism, the way the culture teaches us to be passive in the face of injustice. All of these cultural values contain within them seeds of good and evil, but at the beginning of the talk today, I'm going to talk mainly about the problematic aspects of these cultural values. Let me give you just sort of a list of these isms at the beginning here to give you an idea of what's coming up, and then we'll go through them fairly quickly. Then I want to talk about a couple of isms, personalism and communitarianism, that I think offer some real opportunities for change. The ones that I want to talk about that I think are embodied in the institutions that we've looked at this week are individualism, privatism, consumerism, and for consumerism you might also read materialism or commercialism. Fourth, careerism, and with careerism, credentialism, which is a form of instrumentalism. I'm really amazed at myself for having been able to think of this many isms. The fifth is realism, which I think in this culture often leads to fatalism. The sixth is presentism, which we talked about when we talked about clocks the other day. The seventh is secularism, which we also talked about when we talked about clocks. The eighth is provincialism, or what you might call localism, or parochialism. The ninth is patriotism. I think patriotism often acts as an opposition to activism in American culture. The tenth, which I'm hoping may become obsolete, is anti-communism. The 11th is militarism. The 12th is scientism or rationalism. 13th is pluralism. 14th is optimism, and all of these together, I think, lead to a kind of pacifism. But anyway, let's try this out and see if we can see how these things might work together. And I'll go fairly quickly. The first is individualism, which I think is maybe the premier vice and virtue of American culture. We are so much committed to individualism in American culture that most of the time we never even see it. Edward Stewart, who's written a wonderful book called American Cultural Patterns, which he wrote for people who would be going into Peace Corps and would be overseas and would need to understand their own cultural patterns so that they'd realize that these other people that they were meeting with were not dumb or strange or something like that, but just different. but they need to understand their own cultural patterns. And so he has this wonderful cross-cultural little book for people who might be going overseas. It says, the American self-concept is the integral assumption of the culture. Americans naturally assume that each person is not only a separate biological entity, but also a unique psychological being and a singular member of the social order. Now, the first part of that sentence is always is very interesting to me. Americans naturally assume. Okay, now, what does naturally mean in that case? And almost any time that somebody says that something is naturally assumed, what they really mean is that Americans culturally assume. It's not natural at all to be individualist. In this society, it is, because it's cultural. So almost any time that somebody says it's just natural, you can read it's just cultural. And in this society, it is cultural to be individualist. With individualism, there are values of autonomy, independence, and the self-made man. Self-made man, particularly over our history, perhaps now the self-made woman. The sense that I am who I am because of my own achievement. Because the individual becomes who he or she is, instead of being who he is by virtue of communal ties, which is the difference between achieved and ascribed status. In this culture, I am who I am by virtue of my achieved status. If you are to ask me, essentially, what do you do, or who are you, I'm likely to answer that I'm a professor of American Studies at St. Olaf College. That's an achieved status. That's something that I've worked for and achieved. I'm not likely to answer that I'm the son of Lee and Eileen Farrell, which is an ascribed status. And in many other cultures, they work within patterns of ascribed status, where you are who you are by virtue of adherence to a certain community. In this culture, almost always, people will give you an individualist answer to the question of who are you or what do you do. We also, because of our individualism, stress externalized achievement. Okay, we stress achievement that other people can see. So. We stress the things that people around us can see, partly because as an individualist culture, even though we're individualist, we're not real confident about ourselves. And that's partly because we're in competition with each other all the time. And so I keep doing things externally to make you think that I'm brilliant or wonderful or something like that. And I figure out for myself that I am brilliant or wonderful because you, in a way, inform me of that. And in a way, I learn who I am by the mirror of other people reflecting back to me my externalized achievements. And because of that, I'm likely to remain throughout my life mostly unconfident about what people might have in the past called character. I'm probably more interested in my life as an American in personality. The image that I might project, than in character, which is a kind of substantial rootedness in values. Okay, now the corollary to this American individualism is conformity. Because we are individuals, because we define ourselves and others by the quality of our choices, we necessarily need to pay attention to the ways that others are evaluating their choices. As David McClellan says, Americans want to freely choose to do what others want them to do. Because our individualism, in a way, is dependent on the approval of other people, we freely choose, in a way, to enslave ourselves to the social values of people around us. The consequence is that in American culture, we have a great activity for individual self-interest, but a poverty of communal ties, of duties and obligations. And a good part of what I'm going to talk about at the end of this talk is the necessity of having duties and obligations and of reinforcing institutions that call us to duties and obligations as opposed to the individual freedom that we're so used to as part of the mainstream American culture. In the American self, there is a remarkable absence of community, says Stewart in his book. A remarkable absence of community, tradition, and shared meaning which impinge upon perception and give shape to behavior. We do act largely as individuals, and as a result of that, we don't feel much community in our lives. Now, individualism is, I think, connected to the second of the isms that I want to talk about, privatism. And privatism, for me, describes mainly the split between private and public realms. It dates back to and especially between the household and the workplace. It dates back to the 19th century when as you move to a more urban and industrial culture, work moved out of the home. Until the 19th century in the United States, work was almost always in the home, and so the family culture and the work culture were very closely integrated. In the 19th century, these things began to separate out, and private life is sort of relegated to the home. Women and private life were associated, and men and public life were associated. Now, Even in public life, though, individuals were working for their individual self-interest. Individuals are working in the public realm for the self-interest of their family, to make money, to support their family, to pass money on to their future generations. In the 19th century, Commodore Vanderbilt was very explicit about this. Somebody once told him that he couldn't do something with one of his railroads because the public wouldn't like it. And he said, "The public be damned." And I think that in many ways in our own culture, even though we're not likely to say "the public be damned," I think we act that way because of privatism. We believe in private enterprise in this country, and I think that's a part of privatism, even though, in fact, there has never been any, there is some private enterprise in this country, but if you go back to the very beginning, there's very little private enterprise. The first English people to land on these shores, in the Virginia Company and the Massachusetts Bay Company, were members of corporate charters. They were not acting in terms of private interest. They were acting in the public interest. They had charters from the king to do something publicly for the realm of England. And we look back at these people as sort of the rugged individualists who settled America. They are not rugged individualists. They are working out of a corporate charter. And in New England especially, they were not rugged individualists. They hated the idea of living apart early on. They wanted to live in close communal communities, and they arranged their land in those early New England communities. Actually, these early New England people were communists in the most basic sense of the word. If they got a large land grant like this, with all of these words on it here, they would always put the houses at the middle of the land grant, and they would have the church there and the village common, which was the which common is related to the word community, and the common was where you grazed your livestock in common. And then they would give out the land in strips around the community like this. And they would arrange the strips so that all of your strips weren't together. So let's say that Maury would get this strip here, and he'd get a strip over here, and he'd get a strip over here. And the idea of this was to make it very difficult for him to work those individually. So they worked in collective groups. They farmed all the fields together, and they would move around together and do the fields together in the very early years of it. Now, it turned out that America, the land in America was so good, and the conditions of life in America were so good compared to England, they very quickly became Yankee individualists. It only took them about 100 years to accomplish that. There's a wonderful book by Kenneth Lockridge called A New England Town, which describes this transformation from what he calls these communal, these very, very tightly communal conditions to the individualism of the 18th century. But there's still, in the 18th century, more communal obligation, as we'll see in a minute, than there is now. Now, this is related also to what Richard Flax calls the post-war charter. He says that after World War II, Americans essentially make what he calls a post-war charter with their government. And the deal is this: we will let the government do what it wants in terms of government policy as long as the economy improves. As long as the economy keeps going well, the government can do whatever it wants. We don't care, and we'll stay out of it. That's the deal. We'll stay out of the government if they provide us with prosperity, which allows us to have the goods that we want in our private lives. Okay? The only times that we get actively involved are when the economy sort of goes downhill. And a really good example of that is in the late 1970s, when the economy kind of flattened out in the 1970s, especially for the middle class. And at the end of the 1970s, you get Proposition 13 and all the kind of activism about limiting taxes because the government had violated the post-war charter. The prosperity had stopped in the 1970s. The middle class got mad and said, okay, do it again. We want that prosperity to come back. And I think Reagan's election is largely due to the sense that the middle class had that the post-war charter, which provided for private benefits, had been violated. Now, the original meaning of private in Greek culture was not holding office or public position, thus deprived or bereaved, because it was important for people to be in public life all the time. This meaning is still holds in the army, where the private is the lowest thing that you can be. In Greek culture, to be private was to be in some ways below normal. You were meant to be public all of the time. It was supposed to be an integral part of life. I think our privatism also detracts to some extent from citizenship in this country. Citizenship in this country is now largely defined by voting every 4 years, which is a really kind of minimal exercise of public responsibility. And I actually normally spell it with an S. It's S-I-T-I-Z-E-N, because it's just sitting. You know, mostly that's what we do as citizens in this country. And And what communitarianism or personalism would call us to is a more active kind of citizenship. Okay, now the third thing, which we've talked about quite a bit this week, is consumerism, the way that we consume the earth in the course of our everyday lives. And we have talked about that quite a lot. But consumerism also has to do with who we are. We create what Stuart Ewan calls commodity selves. And we begin to define ourselves by the commodities that we have. So that when I'm driving my sleek convertible up the road here to Holden one of these days when I ship it in, you know, you'll know that I'm cool because of the commodity that I have. And in many ways, we define ourselves by the commodities that we have. And in fact, that's one way that I can tell students that they always do sociology. They know how to do sociology because they can tell on a college campus by the way that people dress, the way that they're likely to act, or the kinds of associations that they're likely to make. So we create these commodity selves out of the properties that are given to us in a commercial culture. Okay, now this commercialism or consumerism is connected to capitalism, which is based upon private ownership of the means of production. And again, that word private is important, such as land, minerals, and tools, and manufacture for profit rather than for use, and the sale of labor as a commodity. And this idea of commercialism, as we said the other day, leads us to always want more. That seems to be sort of the rallying cry of American culture. And it leads us away from the idea, which was standard in earlier times in American culture, of what was called a sufficiency. That was what you hoped to pass on to your children, was a sufficiency, enough. Okay, my fourth ism is careerism. And here I have a story to tell. For about 10 years after we got married, and about 3 or 4 years after I became a college professor, my father-in-law would ask me, only half in jest, what I was going to do when I grew up. And this did not mean, what would I do when I grew tall? It meant, when was I going to get a job that paid enough money that I could support his daughter in a style to which he wanted her to become accustomed? His daughter, by that time, was a lawyer. It had really no sense in terms of money. She was already making more money than I was. The idea was that as a man, it was my responsibility to make enough money in my career to support his daughter. He died thinking that I was a failure. In his terms, I was. Historically, this has been very hard on men, and this is what I would call the cult of true manhood. There's a very famous article from the 19th century by Anne Douglas? No. I can't remember who it's by right now. Called The Cult of True Womanhood, and it describes what in the 19th century a woman was supposed to be. But there was associated with that, and not so much written about, a cult of true manhood. And the idea was that you had to make a living, you had to make money in order to be a real man. And there's a wonderful example of a deviant from the cult of true manhood in the novel Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. Rebecca's father is a dancer and a man who makes music, and he doesn't make much money by it. And the community essentially drives him to his death because he's not fulfilling what they would call the cult of true manhood. Okay, now careerism is the trajectory of an individual and his or her dependence. Okay, so we think about my career as a college professor. And this is unlike a vocation, which is much broader than that. A vocation always locates one's work or the work of an individual in the context of a community. And I find it very interesting that at St. Olaf, very few students are very much aware of the language of vocation at all. We often read Habits of the Heart in my class, and Habits of the Heart makes the distinction between vocation and career and job. And most of the students have a fairly good sense of what career might be and a fairly good sense of what job might be, but no sense that vocation is just simply means that you are called to do something for the public good, for the commonwealth. And I find that very sad, and so they always get a kind of harangue from me about thinking about vocation. Now, because careerism is not located in the public context, it often leads to a kind of specialization that makes it hard to see the common good. In a career like the college professor's career, it's often important to get as specialized as you can so that you can publish in these really remote areas that nobody cares about except for other college professors and their journals. But if you want to make a career of it, that's the way you want to go. And in many, many instances in business, too, the more specialized you can get, the kind of specialized talent you can get, the better off you are. Careerism also, I think, leads to alienation, because I think the more specialized you get, the more you're missing out on sort of communities. I mean, eventually you get so specialized that you're a specialist on the first three chapters of some novel, and the only people you can talk to are the other specialists on that first three chapters of the novel. So you've taken yourself out of a much larger community that you would have. And then, because you're alienated by your careerism, you take to the compensations of consumerism and mass entertainment, which we talked about before. Much work in America is alienating. As a result of the alienating work, because we've structured workplaces that way and let them go that way, we decide to take the compensation of consumerism and mass entertainment. We say, as I talked about the other day in The Great Compromise, I'll do any dumb work you want as long as you pay me well enough that I can have a boat and a cabin or whatever else it might be. In my, quote, private life. And so again, this is connected to privatism. Okay, now, what precedes careerism, and which you see at colleges like St. Olaf, is what I would call credentialism. Credentialism is the apprentice form of careerism, as young people work to get credentials that will allow them to practice specializations. So you have people coming in wanting to get a particular major so that they can go on to graduate or professional school to get even more specialized. And it's really sad to see that, especially at liberal arts colleges. And it's really the role of the faculty at liberal arts colleges to try to get, sort of deflect students from that narrow path to something broader and richer and more like vocation. I think that's really the job that we have. Okay, the fifth ism is what I would call realism. Realism is the idea that what could be can't be. Okay, the idea that what could be can't be, as opposed to idealism, which is the notion that what should be could be. Okay? Langdon Winner contends that we are, quote, in a world of bizarre inversion, where we waste money on arms instead of investing it in people, where we mine irreplaceable resources, where we consume the people of the world. In situations like these, he says, we become used to accepting deplorable conditions as normal. We become used to accepting deplorable conditions as normal. To be realistic, to get things done, and to get on with one's career almost requires that a person become an enemy of a free humanity and a healthy biosphere. Now, I think this realism is connected to fatalism, the sense that events are predetermined by fate and out of our control. Dorothy Suella says, there's nothing we can do about it is the voice of practical atheism. When we say there's nothing we can do about it, it's the voice of practical atheism. And she says that it's opposed to faith, which is measured, according to Suella, by our being empowered to love and do justice. That faith is what gives us the opportunity to move away from realism, to move away from fatalism. And this relates to the matins the other morning. Now, if you remember, Leah talked about castles in the air, the Thoreau's, that wonderful Thoreau quotation, that you should have your castles in the air, and now that the job is to build foundations under them. And this sounds kind of dreamily idealistic. But, I mean, consider what we're doing right now. We are sitting right now in a castle in the air. This was Wes Priebe's castle in the air. It is now an ongoing institution. The college that I teach in was a 19th century castle in the air. We inhabit castles in the air a lot of our lives, and we don't know it because we don't pay attention to that sort of thing. We think that idealism doesn't work, but in many cases idealism does work because people have taken the time to put the practical foundations under somebody's dream. Okay, my sixth ism, which we talked about earlier in the week and I won't talk about very much now, is presentism. The sort of critical time orientation that keeps us focused on ourselves rather than on our ancestors or our heirs. If we were to focus on our ancestors, we would be focusing more on the traditions that give us life, and we'd be focusing more on a kind of history that tells us the ways in which human beings can live well, which I think is part of what the job of history is to do, is to show the ways in which human beings can live well. And it gives us examples, both bad and good, of the ways that people live together. And we also need to focus on our heirs, and we've talked a lot about this week. And I think that this is connected to individualism also, because individualism, the life of an individual, is a present kind of life. It doesn't have much extension one way or another. And as we get more and more self-absorbed, we tend to forget the past and also to forget the future. And it's this idea of envisioning the future, I think, is real important. We don't do it very often. Talked about this the other day, that Global 2000, when Jimmy Carter did it in the late 1970s, was considered visionary because he was thinking 22 years ahead. But that in many cultures, that many people have had an idea of posterity, which was that you have to think several generations ahead. We mentioned John Adams thinking four generations ahead. And that here, this fits very nicely with Alan Derning's book, where the last chapter is called A Culture of Permanence. Can we create a culture that can become permanent? Just to say, can we create a sustainable society? The culture we have now is not a culture of permanence. It's a culture that's doomed to disappear in one way or another because we can't sustain it over time. We can't sustain it physically because of the sort of finitude of resources, and I'm not sure that we can even sustain it socially because of the lack of community and the lack of fulfillment that it gives us. Okay, a seventh ism is secularism, our focus on the temporal rather than the spiritual, which is another way of saying a too narrow focus. Like presentism, secularism gives us a focus in time when we need to have a sense of what's out of time also. I'll pass over that one quickly because I want to make sure we have some time to talk here at the end. Another one is provincialism or localism or parochialism, and this is in space a correlative of presentism and secularism. It's to say that we mainly think about the very small spaces that we normally inhabit. We normally think about our town or our neighborhood or something like that, and we restrict our attention and energies to our neighborhoods and we ignore the ways in which localities are tied up in national and international policies and practices. And a good example of this is in all the stuff over garbage now. I live in a town that successfully closed down a garbage dump, and we're very happy about that. But our garbage has got to go somewhere, and most of us don't care at all where it goes, as long as it goes to some other town or someplace else. This is what they call the NIMBY syndrome, not in my backyard. There's something I think interesting in the NIMBY syndrome, very interesting, because it's saying we don't want our communities to be ruined by the wastes of our consumer society. And potentially it's very radical, because if you can associate them with other communities, you can begin to think about ways of cutting down to waste. Right now, I don't think it's very radical. Right now, I think it's really a distraction in a way, and a way of trying to throw stuff onto other people. It's an irresponsible kind of thing. As David De Leon says in an essay of his, he says, in modern society, how do you throw something away when there is no away? And there is no away, because we all inhabit the planet. Martin Luther King Jr. in the letter from Birmingham Jail speaks to this idea of provincialism or localism. He had been demonstrating in Birmingham in 1963, and eight ministers in Birmingham wrote a letter to the newspaper and said that they ought not to have been there because King really had no business there, because he was an Atlanta minister and he was sort of an outside agitator coming in to stir things up. And King responded to that in the letter from Birmingham Jail. He says, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Or a little bit later in his life, in Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, he's talking about the civil rights movement and asking black people not to get simply focused on the civil rights movement. And he says this, however deeply American Negroes are caught in the struggle to be at last at home in our homeland of the United States, we cannot ignore the larger world house. And I love this phrasing, world house, because it's the root both of economy and ecology. Oikos is the house or household. But anyway, we cannot ignore the larger world house in which we are dwellers. Equality with whites will not solve the problems of either whites or Negroes if it means equality in a world society stricken by poverty and in a universe doomed to extinction by war. Now, he's involved in an extraordinary social movement, but says essentially to his followers, this social movement is too small. It needs to be larger. We need to be more comprehensive in our view of the world. We need to be less localistic. Okay, ninth ism is patriotism. In a wonderful novel called The Nuclear Age, Tim O'Brien calls it the Benedict Arnold disease. It's one of the hazards. We all grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think often people who are protesting something are simply seen as un-American. And I think this is unfortunate. And especially in regard to the Pledge of Allegiance, which was such a big deal in the 1988 campaign, you know, reciting the PA. It was interesting to me what we hear in the Pledge of Allegiance. We don't tend to hear the word Republic in its original sense, and to the republic for which it stands. Republic comes from a Latin word, or two Latin words, res publica, the public things. We are committed to the public things when we say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute here. And we also tend to put more emphasis in the last phrase on liberty than on justice for all. I mean, when we say the Pledge of Allegiance, we're there at the end with liberty and justice for all. But it tends to be in this society that we're much more interested in liberty, because that fits much better with individualism than with justice for all, which really calls us to a more communitarian kind of existence. Now, the idea of republicanism is an idea that I find very interesting. It's really the ideal that the American nation was founded on in the 18th century. Small R republicanism, before the invention of the Republican Party. The idea was that citizens were called to be a part of the public good. They had to be concerned with the res publica. And I think at one point John Adams said, you can only have a republic if the people are virtuous. Okay, and the idea of civic virtue is absolutely associated with this 18th century idea of republicanism, that people have to be good in order to have a republic. And people, to be good means to think about the public good in every seemingly private thing that you do. In Northfield, Division Street is the main street there, and teenagers tend to kind of cruise up and down, going nowhere in particular, from one end to the other. You know, it's back and forth and back and forth. Now, if they were thinking as Republicans, small R Republicans, they might not do that. They might walk up and down, although it wouldn't be as cool, you know. But they might walk up and down because it would save energy. Now, the last person I know that has called the American people to 18th century republicanism was Jimmy Carter. And this was in 1979 when the energy crisis was on. Carter comes on TV and he says, here's the deal with the energy crisis. You people are driving too damn much. Cut back on your energy use. The problem is what he called malaise. It's the American people. They're not paying attention to this. They're not practicing civic virtue. Now, he got crucified for that. Edward Kennedy just leaped on him right away and said, it's not the fault of the American people, it's the fault of their government. But I think Carter was right. It was the fault of the American people. It was the culture which constructs for us a kind of an easy energy mentality. And it works in all kinds of things, too. We tend not to think of the public good at all in what we think are the seemingly private aspects of our life. But what we've seen a lot this week is that there really aren't very many private aspects of our lives. We could even get into something that seems more private than television or cars that we've talked about now. We even get to something like sexuality and see how sexuality is socially and publicly constructed. That when my wife and I are just about to kiss, we're enacting something that we've been taught socially and publicly. I often ask my students this, you know, how do you know how to kiss somebody? You know, it's not a, quote, natural sort of thing. It's a social kind of thing. It's a cultural kind of information. And the way we teach people to kiss is a way in which public life becomes a part of what we think is private life. And very few people actually get instructions in this, although I'd love to teach a class in which you actually took a little time to sort of go through the theory of it, you know, and exactly, you know, how the osculation ought to work, you know. I think that would be a lot of fun. We don't do a lot of that. But anyway, this republicanism, I think, is related to patriotism. You can't use patriotism to work against people working against injustice. Because, as Clarence Darrow said early in the century, true patriotism hates injustice in its own land more than anywhere else. Okay, a tenth is anti-communism. And I hope this is going to die out as the Soviet Union has now collapsed. But I'm reminded very much of Domhilder Camara in Brazil, who said, when I gave food to the hungry, I was called a Christian. When I question the causes of hunger, I was called a communist. Mm-hmm. And this is the way that anti-communism worked very much in American life. It was okay to be philanthropic. It was okay to be charitable to other people who were experiencing injustice. It was not okay to call into question the sort of social constructions that created injustice in America. Okay, 11th form of this, which also may decline with the end of the Cold War, is militarism. Which, if you look it up in the dictionary, is the glorification of the ideals of a professional military class. I don't think we do a lot of that in the United States. But the second definition is the predominance of the military in the administration or policy of the state. And I think we have a lot of that. And this works out in a whole variety of different ways. When we were talking about cars the other day, I was looking for this statistic and I couldn't find it, but it's here in this set of notes. David Orr estimates that we pay $152 a barrel for $18 a barrel oil if you factor in the cost of our military preparations for the protection of oil supplies in the Middle East. Those never get factored in. All we pay for gas is what the private companies are able to charge us because they, you know, get the oil and then refine it and then give it to us in gasoline and things like that. But we are also paying military costs, and David Orr wrote this before the Gulf War, and now the cost would be much higher than that because of all the billions of dollars that we spent in the Gulf War. We pay an extraordinary amount for things that come to us from other countries because we have to have a military might to assure these vital interests of the United States around the world. And militarism kills without war because it distracts resources. It diverts resources from other places than it might be. Okay, a 12th ism is scientism, which is the acceptance of scientific method as the basis for all inquiry and a surrender of value to science. In a way, when we do that, we leave the natural world to the scientists, and we sort of leave the values out of it. Now, around Holden, that doesn't happen very much, and so it's up here, it's even hard to believe that it happens out there, but it happens a lot. And this is also associated with education, where a lot of the different disciplines in education have tried to be more and more scientific over time, trying to become more and more statistical, more and more the social sciences trying to become more like natural sciences, the humanities like history trying to become more like the social sciences. The biggest failing in higher education today is that the university is rooted in the scientific method, said Johns Hopkins University President Stephen Muller at his inauguration in the 1980s. The problem, he thought, is that the scientific method doesn't provide a value system and leaves us turning out what he called skilled barbarians. This is also, I think, associated with the cult of objectivity in education, the idea that in a classroom you need to be objective for some reason or another. This is something I find very hard to practice in my class. In fact, I don't practice it in my classes. I practice as much as possible a kind of clear subjectivity so that my students know what I think and why I think it. But they also know that I can understand other ways of thinking. So that I'd used to teach a class on nuclear weapons in American culture, and they would know from the very beginning of that class that I'm not very fond of nuclear weapons or even nuclear power. But when we got to the Reagan administration, we would do this sort of scenario where I would play Reagan and see if they could convince me to get rid of any of my nuclear weapons, because I knew all of the arguments that you would use from that side of things. And unfortunately for my teaching, they were not very good at doing it. I was usually able to hang on to almost all of my weapon systems. I would have liked to have given more of them up. But it was a way of being able to see the various sides of things.
Jim, new course in my school, ChemCom, chemistry community, both high schools in the district.
Nice.
So they're bringing the marriage of values.
Yeah, I'm hoping that will happen more and more. I'm hoping that as we revise the curriculum of the paracollege, right now it's divided into divisions, and the natural sciences are one of the divisions, and you seldom practice the natural sciences with anything else. But I'm hoping that these divisional lines will break down and that we'll begin to do more things across disciplinary barriers. Now, this idea of scientism is opposed to earlier ideas and even what we would call, quote, primitive ideas of animism, the idea that there is life and spirit in nature. Native American cultures simply believe in animism, that the earth is alive, that you converse with animals, that before you kill an animal, you need to speak to it and tell it that you're thankful for its sacrifice and things like that. Kinds of things that Americans would now think that you're nutty if you did. Again, except for maybe here at Holden, you know. I had a religion professor when I was in the late 1960s. I was in Rome, and this really strange man was there. And one of his assignments in a course on the Pauline epistles was to go out and talk to trees. And so he had only 35 or 40 students at a group of maybe 150. We're out there, you know, just chatting up with trees. It looked very weird if you weren't a member of the course, and for me it felt very weird too. I wasn't much into animism at that time, but now a little farther along, I can see some virtue in that paying attention in that sort of way. Okay, 13th ism is pluralism, which I think in American culture is associated to relativism, and I think that's related to individualism. The idea is that pluralism, You need to respect all individuals, and so you need to let them all do whatever they want to do. And I think that there's a lot of virtue in pluralism. It's good for its encouragement of tolerance. It's good for its respect for diverse points of view. But I think the problem with pluralism in American culture is that it makes us suspicious of commitments. And it gives us a sense of what Carol Bly calls moral drift, which is that when something is going wrong and we see it, we just sort of let it pass by because we want to respect the individual who's doing the thing that's wrong there. And it's very much opposed to, say, the Puritan view of things. The Puritans were not very good pluralists at all. In fact, they were not pluralists at all. And a good example of that is when Quakers used to come to Massachusetts to sort of preach Quakerism to the Puritans, the first time they would banish them from the colony, and just sort of throw them out. The second time they would whip them and banish them from the colony. And the third time they would kill them. Because they didn't want untrue things to be taught in Puritan culture. Now, I'm not advocating killing people who disagree with us. I am much more of a pluralist than that. But what I see as a virtue in Puritanism was the ability to sort of take a stand and say, for us, for this community, these things seem right. And I think that in many communities now in America, we don't do that. We don't even say that these things seem right. We tend to be so tolerant that there aren't core beliefs or duties and obligations that are related to these core beliefs in the culture. My lastism is optimism or progressivism, which I think is a sense that progress occurs naturally without any activism at all, without any involvement at all. And then I mentioned earlier Martin Luther King in the letter from Birmingham Jail. And again, I'm going to quote that. He says, "Actually, time is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. I am coming to feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. We must come to see that human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability." I love that phrase. Never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and persistent work of men and women willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. We must use time creatively and realize that the time is always right to do right. Okay, so these are the kinds of cultural constructions, I think, that tend to make most of us in American culture passive, to keep us from being activists. Now, I have a lot more to say, but I'm not going to say very much of it. Part of what I want to say in a sort of condensed form is that since, as we've seen in this week, so many of America's problems are problems of everyday life, the solutions are also ones in everyday life, and they needn't be very large. They can be as small as turning off your TV when there's junk on, which would be a lot of the time. They can be as small as buying a car that gets better gas mileage than the one that you have now. We can be empowered to do many, many small things in our lives. And we often don't think of those things as being activism. We think that activism is when you go out and you carry a sign and you get on TV, or you say something big. And I think that's really unfortunate, because I think activism needs to be a part of our everyday lives. It needs to be understood in that way, that we are activists when we are, as King said, doing right. So I would encourage us to think small in terms of activism. And then, if the opportunity presents itself, or if you feel like being a public speaker — actually, the number one fear in American life is of public speaking — and if you feel like being a public speaker for the things that you believe in, fine. But I think it's more important often to be an example of the good than to be a speaker for the good. There's a wonderful essay by Wendell Berry in his book, The Gift of Good Land, called The Garden and the Reactor. And he talks about going to protest a nuclear reactor that was being built near his farm in Kentucky. And he says he really wanted to do that, and he enjoyed doing it, and he thought it was important to do it. But he drove there in a gasoline-powered vehicle. And he says this is mostly true of activists who are protesting things. They're almost always involved in the evils that they want to protest. And this is important to remember, too. It gives us a sense of humility to realize that we're complicit with the evils that we are protesting. And Berry says that protest is what he would call an incomplete action, because he says you can protest against something, but it's hard to protest for something. Actually, I disagree with him here. I think that there's what I would call the affirmative no. I protest against this because I am for this. But anyway, he says that. But then he goes on to say what we need to be engaged in is what he calls complete actions. Actions which have in them an element of protest, but also lead to something of the culture that we want to create, to the kind of culture of permanence, for example, that Alan Derning talks about. And what he suggests in there as a radical alternative is gardening. He says a person who keeps a garden has a sense of place, person who keeps a garden is sort of, to the extent that they're gardening, they separate themselves from the commercial culture. They get a higher quality food than they often get in the commercial culture. They begin to understand the land. They begin to care for it in a particular kind of way. And the gardening, he would say, is a complete action. And you can think of other kinds of complete actions like that. And usually we don't think of gardening as a subversive activity. But actually, subversive comes from roots that mean change from below. So gardening actually works real well for that. It's rooted. It is a change from below. And there are all kinds of subversive activities that we could undertake in our lives without having to go out in public and carry signs and do that sort of thing. Now, I want to suggest that there are two groups in American culture that I find particularly interesting in this sort of transformation, this sort of local transformation. And they're people who call themselves, so they don't call themselves, but who I would call personalists. And that's what this handout is related to here today. And another group called communitarians. The communitarians, I think, are interesting because they focus on the obligations we have to one another that arise from the social nature of human persons. They simply look at American individualism and say, even the individual that you are is a socially created thing. It comes from your parents, it comes from your upbringing, it comes from all kinds of different things. You simply aren't very much on your own at all. It all tends to be a kind of social creation. They focus much more on the interdependent relation of individual and community. And I think interdependence is a word that we all need to think of more. Henry Commager once drafted what he called a Declaration of Interdependence. And I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, a lot of times the Americans focus on the Declaration of Independence, and we take it personally, that we need to be independent. Commager says that what's really much more important, even for a nation, is a Declaration of Interdependence. And I think it's a word that we need to use a lot. The other thing that I want to focus on here is what I call political personalism. And that the handout speaks to that. This is in addition to the research that I'm sort of presenting to you this week on the moral ecology of everyday life. I'm also writing a history of political personalists in the anti-nuclear movement. And it's very, very, very interesting. But anyway, this is a summary that Robert Holdsworth offers of political personalism. And I'd just like to go through some of it here. First of all, is a sense of personal obligation. And as I said early on, obligation is to me a very important part of this. In the bottom there, the demands of morality are not grounded in mathematical calculations. The witness furnished by faithful action has a value that is partially independent of its immediate effectiveness. And that idea of witness is very important. To be a witness is not to be somebody who sees something. To be a witness is to be an active participant in something. When we are, for example, when we go to a wedding, normally we think we're just there as kind of hanging on to see what the bride's wearing and whether or not anybody trips going down the aisle or something like that. But actually, we're witnesses to the marriage. And as Wendell Berry points out in a section of The Unsettling of America on fidelity, the people who are at a wedding are making a pledge also. They're making a pledge of fidelity that involves the married couple. So do we have any married couples in? I have David and Karen over there. We have a married couple over there. So that when we go to their wedding, we are pledging that we will be faithful. I'm pledging that I won't fool around with Karen. And that if David starts fooling around with somebody, I will take him aside and say, you know, maybe this is not a good thing for your marriage, for the vows that you've taken. This is what to be a witness means. And in this sense, to be a witness is to be an exemplar of something, to be an example of something. So witness is very important. And the idea of faithful action is also important, that faith leads to action. And also, I think that action leads to faith. The same weird priest that I had a class from in the late 1960s, in this class on the Pauline epistles, he had a way of speaking that just knocked me off my feet when I was first in there, because he would, every time he used the word God, he would use as a parenthesis after that, if there is a God. So he'd be talking about Paul writing about God, if there is a God. And this false sense that God, if there is a God, would do this, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, this guy is a priest, you know. He doesn't know that there's a God. And so it really threw me at first. And then the more I thought about it, the more I really began to appreciate this idea that he didn't have an absolute certainty or a proof of God or anything like that. But his faith was that he would act as if there were a God, and in the acting as if there were a God, he would be faithful. He would be creating a faith that would be lived by other people as well. I really liked that quite a lot. This idea of personal obligation and of witness also seems to me to be important in the kinds of protests that we undertake. There's a story which may be apocryphal, but even if it is, it's such a wonderful story, I need to tell it, of a guy who's marching in front of the White House, protesting one thing or another, and somebody comes up to him and says, listen, you know, you're here all by yourself, you're carrying a sign by yourself, people look at you like you're just nuts, you're protesting, but you're really not going to change the world at all. And the guy responds, I'm protesting so that the world won't change me. And in fact, I would say, the protest changed the world. His protest changed the world. Whether or not it changed the thing, particular thing on the sign, somebody walked up to him and asked him a question. That changed the world. If he hadn't been there, nobody would have asked that question. And so I think that all the time when we take these little actions, we do change the world. And we change it in ways that we can't anticipate. This is what I was talking about when I talked earlier in the week about the Robert Penn Warren talking about the awful responsibility of time. We need to make decisions in time about what we'll do, either actively or passively, but we can't know what the consequences of them are. We can't know what will come of our teaching in a certain way. And the results of things just go out and out and out. I once had a student who was date raped at St. Olaf and was doing a tutorial with her, and she came in for the next tutorial, and she simply wasn't there. I mean, she was just a vacant face, and so I asked her what was going on, and she told me, and for the rest of the semester, all we did was take walks. Every time we were supposed to meet, we'd just walk and we'd talk, and we were supposed to be reading literature, and every once in a while we read a novel and talked about it, but most of the time we just walked and talked for the whole semester. And like in the paracollege, you can put that on a narrative evaluation, that we just walked and talked, and that worked out fine. And as a result of the date rape and some other things that she was doing in her life, she had called into question the value of college education. She decided to go to Nicaragua and work in Nicaragua, where she married. And now she's come back with a sort of strong self-aware sense. And she works in a lesbian community in Washington, D.C. And she wrote to me, maybe 10 years after she'd left St. Olaf, and said, you are an important person in my involvement as an activist in the lesbian community in Washington. I had never even talked about lesbianism with her, but it's simply a matter of being a personal support for her at that time. But there's no way I could anticipate the results of that action. And many of my actions, I'm sure, also have negative consequences. And we need to think about that as well, that things I teach students, they go out in the world and somebody just zaps them for thinking something as dumb as that, you know. But we can't know the consequences of our actions. But it's important for us to think about the actions that have a kind of potential sense of change for the world. The second thing here on this political personalism, the harmony of political belief and personal life. This is something that we've talked about a lot this week, and I think is simply lived here at Holden. It's related to Wendell Berry's sense that health, wholeness, holiness, and wellness are all related. They all come from the same root. And so that our spiritual life, our social life, and our personal life are all interrelated. The third is the significance of local action, the sense that acting locally has national consequences, that local action is, as it says in the end there, the foundational support for the changes in national policy that will reflect a genuine commitment to disarmament. This is all written about the anti-nuclear movement, so it has all this stuff about peace in it, but it would apply to just about any kind of justice movement. The fourth, which is this commitment to community. Here is this kind of therapeutic thing to help you out when you're involved in the struggle, to be a kind of social support for you. And I think that's important. But I think it's also important as a matter of sustainability. If we're thinking about creating a sustainable world, just in terms of sort of ecology, we need to have sustainable social groups, and we need to have groups that sustain individuals. I don't think that we can have ecologically sustainable world without a socially sustainable system, that we individuals need to be able to get support from communities to continue the work that will be hard,